And this is a man who, because of Nietzsche, is telling this woman to be a slag, basically. Welcome to Groovy Movies. My name is Lily Austin.
And my name's James Brailsford. Hello.
Welcome, everyone, to our new fortnightly release schedule. I hope you enjoyed James' one-man bonus episode from last week.
I had to stop myself going mad with the power. I was like, great, this could be my six-hour Christopher Nolan masterclass.
If we ever get on Patreon, you should do that. I loved it so much. I listened to it like three times. Your voice is so soothing.
Well, you know, want to soothe you into this fortnightly release schedule. Don't want to, you know, upset you. Just got to ease you into it.
Yeah. So yeah, if you missed that from last week, please do go back and listen. It's not very long, but just announcing that we are moving to releasing episodes every 2 weeks. So hopefully that will mean that the quality continues to be great and we can be very topical, as in this episode today, talking about the Oscars from 10 days ago.
Hey, you know, we can't hit every target, Lily.
Well, I think there are certain things where it's good to have a little moment to let it percolate. Exactly. Once the dust has settled, what has really made a lasting impression?
Yeah, which I don't know, has anything much? I felt like this year's Oscars were business as usual.
No, I thought it was a new standard. Like, the Oscars are so boring, but this time they made sure to keep it to a tighter runtime.
Oh, I see, the actual event. Sorry,
the actual event was ratcheting along. Good stuff, good stuff. And we got to enjoy I'm Just Ken. I nearly forgot the name then.
Yeah, which was a highlight, I have to say.
Yeah, if you haven't seen that, Ryan Gosling doing a Marilyn Monroe-esque take on... Did you get the reference of the Gentlemen Prefer Blondes?
Absolutely, yeah. It was a Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend riff, is that right?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, Ryan Gosling in that beautiful pink suit. I just love how he played it so seriously, you know? Like, that's... We want it
but that's
to be
Ken, different. Isn't it?
It's that's earnest. Ken, and that's what makes it funny, you know?
Yeah.
He really played it. And Slash had a cameo. Love that.
I mean, yeah, that you know, always good to see the ageless Slash. I mean, that's a look that lasts you throughout your entire life. You know, he will look the same until the day he dies.
Absolutely. So, okay, but in terms of the actual awards and who won, you've alluded to this. You weren't impressed?
No, it's not that I wasn't impressed. That's completely not what I meant. It just was, whereas last year you had what I would call the plucky outsider, Everything Everywhere All at Once. This time around we've got, you know, it's the kind of things that we expected to win. So they're not unworthy films. I mean, I think Oppenheimer deserved its wins that it got, but everyone was expecting Oppenheimer to win. It wasn't a big surprise, you know?
No, but I have to say, when I was editing our episode on the Oscars, I was a bit... I was a bit disappointed in myself for being like, oh, it's a bit boring. All these films are good. There are no surprises. This is actually an incredible year for film. Just the fact that at least two of the films that were nominated for Best Picture are films that most people have seen, or a lot of people have seen, Barbie and Oppenheimer. Mm. That is unusual. The Oscars usually are talking about movies that only a few real film buffs have gone to see. They're not mainstream movies. And I think that's a real
point,
testament
actually, yeah,
to the fact that we are out of the mess that was the kind of superhero era of the last 10 years.
I don't know. I think we're out of the frying pan into the fire, Lily, but yes.
Why?
Well, because because we've had this emerging from underneath the clouds to see a little bit of golden ray of sun peeking through, right?
Yeah.
Which is like Barbie and Ken. Suddenly movies are back in the pop culture, which, you know, that kind of stuff. And not Marvel movies, not superhero. But there's now no content. There's now, everyone's hyped, everyone's happy to be back in the cinema. There's now a drought of big releases
because
to kind
of
follow
strikes.
That up. Yeah, unfortunately, the rest of this year, there's nothing big doing. That's not to say there's not any interesting smaller films, but the kind of Barbies and Oppenheimers aren't... Dune was it for this year, really.
I'm going to say apart from Dune, and that's gone.
Which is great, but that's just the one. There's no... We're heading into the summer with no kind of the usual tent poles.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. But as long as we can get through this year and cinema will always survive, it is the most enduring art form. There have been many, many strikes in film history. We'll be okay. But yeah, this year might be a bit dry.
But next year, I'm excited for
2025.
It's not the strikes that are the problem. It's the fact that just viewing habits have changed. So what's completely unique is that there have been strikes in the past, but what there's never been is such a proliferation of other choices of entertainment. So it's now fighting for attention with other forms of mass entertainment. That's why I think it's just like I don't want there to be a lost generation who just aren't bothered about films, because then it will go the way of the dodo, you know.
But it's only a year, and kids were very into movies last year, you know, Saltburn. There was so much talk about it. And speaking of, let's talk about the Razzies, Oppenheimer succeeded at the Oscars, a different film came up trumps at the Razzies. James,
don't make me watch this, Lily. Don't make me watch this.
Remind me what it's called.
Oh God! I don't know. Is it called Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey, or something
yes.
like that?
Yes.
It is. Yes. That was me just half guessing. Was it something like? Yeah. There we go. Blood and Honey.
Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey. Yeah, the film that was made because the original Winnie the Pooh books came out of
copyright.
Copyright. Thank you.
They went into the public domain, didn't they?
Went into the public domain. And this particular filmmaker, film company, that is their specialty. They like to make horrors out of...
Oh, so the company's got previous track record. Right, right.
Yeah. I forget what they were, but similar kinds of things. They really... like Brothers Grimm type things. They like to make truly horrifying movies based on children's fairy tales. And now they've moved into the world of Winnie the Pooh. And this completely passed me by, but this was very much an internet thing. So, I mean, pros and cons to how film viewing has evolved, because this film kind of went viral online before it was even finished being made. And so because of all this excitement around it, the film company got more money so they could go back and reshoot more scenes, broaden out the options for their sequel, which will be coming out apparently towards the end of the year.
Oh, in the Winnie the Pooh horror cinematic universe.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah, apparently a major character was killed off originally and then they changed that so they could do more in the sequel.
Oh, they want to bring them back.
Yeah.
They don't want to limit their options.
And the film has gone on from strength to strength because it was meant to be, you know, this tiny movie. I don't think it was even going to go into cinemas, but because of the buzz, it did go into cinemas in some regions. And it won five Razzies this year. It sweeped all the categories it was nominated in.
Well, I mean, at least the filmmakers can genuinely say award-winning film. You know, that'll look good on the old poster title, won't it?
Yeah, I think there are certain films where a Razzie is only a good thing. That's the thing. The Razzies is it's not the nicest of awards. It's not got the best kind of feeling behind it, but I think in this kind of situation, it can actually be a real benefit.
Yeah, I don't know if it's one of these things where just the hype and the meme is definitely the most fun part of the film rather than actually having to sit through and watching it. I suspect that is the least entertaining part of the package. But that's me just assuming.
Yeah, we haven't watched it. We don't know.
We don't know.
Please don't write in and ask us to watch this.
But I wonder if that's going to be, you know, are we entering an era of a slightly more cinematic bad movies, you know? So we've had Madam Web that is still sticking around cinemas. I think it's slowly gaining traction as a, like, this is trash, you have to see it. And I wonder if Winnie the Pooh will get in there. So suddenly cinemas are, I don't know if this is a good thing, but cinemas are the place that you can see really bad movies these days.
Well, sure. I mean, look at The Room. It's long and enduring. Runtime.
God, are we going to be doing a Madam Web special in a few years' time?
No, it's not. Maybe we will. I don't know. Again, I haven't seen it. I can't possibly say. But I think it's too early to say.
I thought that too, Lily. I thought that too. I just thought, no, it's the wrong kind of bad. But I'm getting a feeling.
I think it's more that there just aren't actually all that many movies in the cinema right now. Like, I looked the other day and I was like, there's not that much on. I'm not missing a lot if I don't go this week. So that was the Razzies and the Oscars. Shall we move to the main event?
Absolutely. It's been lovely to chat through this, Lily, but I think our listeners are raring to go. They haven't got time for this dilly-dallying. Let's get down to business. Let's talk about some 1930s black and white Hollywood movie.
So to Babyface.
Absolutely, on to Babyface.
Came out in 1933, directed by Alfred E. Green, and interestingly, written by a man called Daryl F. Zanuck, under a pseudonym of Mark Canfield. this was Depression era America, right? And so rather than paying writers a substantial fee for their story, senior producers at these studios were writing their own scripts and just and paying them to them for a dollar. He was paid a dollar for that script. But then obviously he's the producer right. on the film, which I think you can tell a little bit that the script wasn't written by a writer, yeah. in a sense.
Yeah, yeah.
It's quite sparse.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's a good story. It's a really good story. So kudos to him. But actually, there's a long history, right, of writers who be also being producers. The two things are often quite intertwined.
Yeah. I didn't clock that at all. I knew he'd been the producer on this, but I didn't realize he'd written the script under a pseudonym. So that's very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But James, I have to say, I'm like very pleased with you for choosing this film.
Thanks.
Excellent choice.
Thanks. Like I don't know much about pre-code film, which is why I wanted to do it for the podcast, right? Because, you know, it's always something that sounded interesting. And then you kind of compiled a little list of films that we could talk about. And I did a bit of research as well. And I don't know much about any of them, but I just thought, okay, this one, it stars Barbara Stanwyck, and she's really good in Double Indemnity, which I have seen. So it'd be interesting to see what she was like in her early career. And then reading the plot summary about essentially a woman who sleeps her way to the top will be the quickest and crudest way of summarizing it. I was like, okay, that sounds like it'd be a lot of fun, slash there'd probably be a lot to talk about and unpack here. So, yeah.
Well, also, this film was instrumental in the move from pre-code to full-on code era.
Right? Again, so which was accidental rather than...
Was it? I was like, yeah, really solid choice. I found so many undergraduate theses about Babyface and its involvement in the pre-code era.
Sorry, I really should have played it like I knew all of this stuff. No, it was in the process of researching it. I was the same as well, yeah.
No, that's genius. Your instincts are obviously very, very good.
Yeah, no, they've been finely tuned over decades. It's like, there's something here.
So let's talk about what exactly the pre-code era is. What is pre-code? Before we get to what pre-code horniness is, though I guess the two things are interlinked.
Yeah, I mean, like, I only had a very, very rough knowledge of the what the code was. And the more I've looked into it, it's just kind of very interesting. So basically, there was a group created, the National Board of Review, that was there to kind of enforce this code that we'll get into the history of the code a little bit more. But basically, the code placed restrictions on what could and couldn't be portrayed in films. And of course, the code was created by people who were Republicans. So it's a very right-wing, very kind of Catholic-biased set of what you would call moral guidelines. So that was kind of enforced. And that changed the kind of topics and the way that films could represent certain things on screen. And what I thought, you see, Lily, is, until I did this research, I thought the pre-code era was just everything before the code. But when you research it, actually what is referred to as the pre-code era is actually a very tiny window. It's post the Great Depression of 29, and that meant that people weren't going into cinemas, so cinema attendance was tanking. So studios were like, how do we get the cinemas full again? Okay, let's fill them full of sex, violence, alcohol, and or drugs. Some combination of all the lot, like really, really tabloid sensational subjects. And so the theatres were getting rammed. People were loving it. So it got people back into the cinema. But of course, it was outraging the moral right. They were like, what the hell's happened to cinema? It's become this decadent art form. So we need to restrict it. So you've basically got from 1930, when all the studios started pushing this much more extreme form of cinema, let's say, to 1933, when the kind of the pre-code, because it started off being like more recommendations that weren't really enforced. Then like by 1933, they were being enforced. So that's the pre-code era and the code kind of part of it.
Yeah, yeah. It's very interesting, right? It's actually a lot.
Oh, there's like there's the onion peels off. Like.
The onion peels. Yes, because actually, having listened to a very good episode on the Hays Code on You Must Remember This, the
excellent podcast,
the film podcast, so we'll link to that in the show notes. It's good for a proper deep dive. It actually turns out that code of rules was suggested by senior people at Paramount.
Yeah, I didn't know that when I was reading your notes. That was interesting.
Wild. So over a steak dinner in 1921, Paramount had organized this meeting with other senior people in Hollywood, because around this time there was a lot of outcry about the debauchery of Hollywood.
So this is in the 20s, so this is before the Depression.
Yeah, it was kind of, yeah, I guess sort of peak racy flap era, where Hollywood is still, it's a business, but it's the Wild West. It's still very, very early days of Hollywood and they're figuring things out. And there's a lot of scandal in Hollywood. And so Catholic pressure groups were saying, no, 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 this cannot be. And so various states were coming up with their own censorship guidelines. Well, not even guidelines. They were just like cutting films and coming up with their own ideas.
Which is a nightmare because each state's going to apply things differently. So your film's going to get butchered in multiple different ways.
Exactly. One state will cut out a scene of someone smoking, another of the different scene, and it's just, it's not ideal. So ideal. And there was also the looming fear of federal censorship because that's what these groups were calling for. So Paramount's senior guys were like, we got to get ahead of this, guys. Here is a list of 14 codes of conduct, including things like no suggestive dancing, no ridicule of religion, no lustful kissing, no miscegenation, which is, I had to Google that, that's sexual activity between the races. They were saying we can't have that. So some really like fraud stuff going on in there too. And they said, if we follow this code, then we'll be able to get ahead of it. But it was actually a bit of a
slide of
hand. Smokescreen that Paramount's plan was that we'll get these other studios to do that, but we won't do it ourselves. And then everyone will come see our films because ours will be the racial ones.
Genius.
Genius. But unfortunately, someone at Paramount leaked the list to the press. And then the National Board of Review said, oh, great. Thank you for that list. We'll start enforcing that. So Will Hayes was brought in at this point to oversee this review board. Because really, even though I always thought of the Hayes Code, oh, this like this tyrant of morality had been there enforcing these rules. Actually, he was really a PR man that wanted to make the studios seem like they were following the law of the land, even though they weren't at all.
Yeah, that's the thing. I didn't realize that really, you know, for the first few years, everything was business as usual, and he was just a front man. It was all a smokescreen. So because it's called the Hayes Code, you think he'd be the enforcer. It turns out when you look into it, there was a guy called Joseph Breen, who was appointed to enforce the code in 1934. Until the kind of dissolution of the code in the 60s, he was the man. He was the guy who would have the power to censor scripts. So Will Hayes was the public figure, but it was Joseph Breen who was the actual, the enforcer, the person who we should be like booing. He's the panto villain of this piece.
Exactly. But to get to this panto villain, we needed some films that would really push the envelope. And Babyface was one such movie.
Hell yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about Babyface. Enough of the history of the Hayes Code, as much as, I mean, I could talk about it for hours. It's like quite fascinating. But we're here to talk about Babyface.
Yep.
So talk me through it, babe. Should we start from the beginning? Who's in the movie?
Well, Barbara Stanwyck, it's like, I've only seen her in Double Indemnity, but Barbara, it's like an early role, if not one of the first roles for her. And then the other actors, I'm not so, I'm not familiar with. Bloody John Wayne.
Didn't even recognize him. Now, he is the true baby face of the piece. Because
he really is.
So young and cute. You just, honestly.
You want to get a chubby little cheeks.
You wouldn't know. And he has a very, very small part as one of the men that Lily Powers uses.
Yeah, you absolutely, from his performance, you know, from his appearance in this film, you would have no inclination that he would turn out to be one of the prominent movie stars the next few decades from, you know, from that. It's, you know, it's just a small part, but yeah, fascinating to see him there.
Absolutely. Okay, so Barbara Stanwyck plays the most fantastically named Lily Powers. So we meet Lily Powers at a speakeasy. Where are they living?
Is it Chicago?
I thought it was somewhere more southern.
Okay, yeah, unsure.
I might be totally wrong about that. Would be great if we knew, but guys, it's not that person's the plot.
She's growing up a bit out of the way in the sticks, wherever it is. It's not in the heart of all the beating action of the big city. That's the point. And she has an abusive father who I think pimps her out.
Yeah, so we meet her in this bar, and she's being leched on by all the men in this bar. Mm. And then you learn that. She has this awful relationship with her father. He's really horrible to her. There's also another woman who works at the bar called Chico, played by Teresa Harris, a black woman who, at the beginning, it's kind of set up that the father wants to fire her for some unreasonable reason.
Misdemeanor, yeah.
Yeah, and Lily is like, she goes, I go. So you understand that they are like good friends.
But there's still a power dynamic, is it? Because she does save her job from being fired because if she goes, I go. But then she goes, now clear up the mess, and off she trots, you know.
Yeah, we can talk about the race relations of this film because it's kind of, it's an interesting one. It's like, slightly more nuanced than you might expect, but
yes, that,
but no, but not, it's, not it's, great.
let's just say, come on, it's 1933. It's probably reflecting of the attitudes of Hollywood at the time.
Yeah, I think you're right. It is reflective of that time, but I think we should discuss it because it's interesting. But we'll get to it later. So. Yeah. So yeah, so we meet Lily there, and then quite quickly, her father is killed in a fire. I don't mean to laugh at that.
But what I love about this film, though, is it doesn't hang about. I was thoroughly swept up in this film. It's like less than 90 minutes, which always gets a thumbs up from me. So yeah, things happen at a breakneck pace here. So yeah.
This is a film that is an hour and 15 minutes. It's one of the shortest films I've ever seen. And I actually think this is the one instance in my life of this film could have been done with being slightly longer. It doesn't hang about, but I think there's scope for just a little bit of time on each of the kind of beats of the film. Just a little.
Oh, yeah.
Just a few minutes on each. But I like that as a criticism. What a novel thing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, if you aren't too keen of older films because you think they're boring, then this rattles along.
Yeah, you honestly won't be bored. And you can... We'll link to where you can watch it. But actually, I'm skipping over really the most pivotal moment of the film. So yeah, father dies. But before we get to that...
There's like a character actor called Afonso Ithier, I think. Apology for mispronouncing him. But he plays a character called Craig, who's like... is he a clockmaker or something? I don't know. But he's an older guy who frequents the speakeasy, who's trying to... help Lily better herself, I suspect. But he's trying to get her to read Nietzsche, you know.
we need to pause on this. The fact that Nietzsche is so pivotal to this plot, which is something that the censors wanted to remove from it, but it's kind of extraordinary. He's like, have you read Nietzsche yet? And she's like, no, I'm not going to read that. It's boring.
Yawn.
And he gives her this speech, this incredible speech, which sets up...
Well, this is after her dad's died and she's a bit at a loss to see
him. Oh, is it after? I was thinking it was before. That makes sense. It is after. Yeah. She's like, oh God, what do I do now? Dad's died, hated him anyway, so I'm not totally sad about it. But where is my life going? And he makes a speech, right? I'm going to read it out because I think it's kind
such
of
a good slide. I was watching this with my mouth. I was like, wow, I wasn't expecting this.
I know. Okay. A woman, young, beautiful like you, can get anything she wants in the world because you have the power over men, but you must use men, not let them use you. You must be a master, not a slave. You hear the Nietzsche coming in here. Look here, Nietzsche says, all life, no matter how we idolize it, is nothing more nor less than exploitation. That's what I'm telling you. Exploit yourself. Go to some big city where you can find opportunities. Use men. Be strong. Defiant. Use men to get the things you want.
Now, if that isn't the ultimate form of what they call a call to action in a film, I don't know what is.
Yeah, and she takes it very, very seriously because from the next scene on, this is a film about a woman. And it says using them. She is using herself, exploiting her own self sexually in order to get ahead.
Yeah.
To take advantage of her clearly irresistible smile and wants to get what she wants in life.
Yeah. And she, you know, the film's called Babyface. And I love the fact that every time she's about to seduce a man, you hear in the background, Babyface. It's like a little theme tune that comes in like, oh, what's she going to do now? They've got no chance. They've got no chance. They are going down.
The charm is being turned on. I need to pause on it because, yeah, you said, I don't know how old Craig is actually in the movie, the actor who plays him, but... He's meant to be a quite old man.
Yes, yeah. He's the Obi-Wan Kenobi of this film, really.
And this is a man who, because of Nietzsche, is telling this woman to be a slag, basically. It's just the most bonkers premise.
And he's like a clockmaker, you know, so this is all taking place, this call to action about use men, exploit them. This setting is like a clock or like maybe it's a cobbler, but the whole situation is very, I've never seen anything like it. So can we kind of dig down into her first seduction and the whole seduction thing? Is
Please right? God, let's get into the seduction.
Okay, so yeah, so we've been called into action by this Obi-Wan-esque Kenobi Nietzsche quoting.
Can I just pause for the fact that you call him Obi-Wan. Is that a northern thing? I think it's probably. Obi-Wan. But you know more about Star Wars than I do. I've never heard anyone call him Obi-Wan.
No, I think you're completely right, and I'm just mispronouncing it. Obi-Wan, I was going to
skirt over it, but as it's coming up again, I can't not.
No, I think you've highlighted a misquotation I've been doing all my life. Oops. Anyway.
But anyway, back to Obi-Wan. So, Obi-Wang, more like.
So we call to action. So off Babyface goes with her newfound mission. You know, she's got the zealot's eyes as she's like, yes, I am going to do this. And off she goes.
And we have the second beat of Chico being very much a prop for anything that Lily Paz does. Because as you rightly noted, in that early scene, it was like, hey, if she goes, I'll go, but get back to work, Chico. And now it's, come on, Chico, we're best friends. Come with me to New York.
We're best friends going on an adventure.
Who cares what Chico's got going on in that town?
No, absolutely. No.
She's there as her sidekick.
It's like watching it. I imagine anyway that this would have been seen as progressive by the left, as like you treat your kind of servant as a friend-ish.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like the film thinks that she's not just a servant. I think the film thinks that these people are genuinely friends, and it's showing that Lily is a progressive person, because look at her caring about this black woman. Isn't that so nice of her? But
exactly.
The film also, in so doing, shows this dynamic and how this woman is being used to colour Lily Powers' character. Like, we really don't get to know Chico at all.
Absolutely.
In fact, I read an interview with Teresa Harris, the actress who plays her, because she was a jobbing actress in Hollywood throughout this period and mostly wasn't credited at all. This is one of the few films she was credited in.
Ah, right.
And basically only played parts as maids. It's like, yeah, pretty depressing. So back to the first seduction.
Yes, the first seduction. So it's like of a very junior clerk whose name I can't remember. But what I love is the seduction sequences, because I don't know. I don't know what you thought of them, Lily, but I thought, God, these are quite hot. If I was in the cinema in the 1930s on the big screen, and like she always has like a little line just before she goes kiss, like, hold me close or something. It's delivered in a very deeply voiced way. And like, holy shit, you know, she's really going for it. Yes, baby face, whatever you want, baby face. Yes, I'm hypnotized. I can imagine there was a lot of husbands there hot under the collar in 1933.
Well, you could definitely tell that this is a pre-code film, in that she, talk me through what happens in this seduction. We're being a bit vague here.
Well, she kind of goes into the office space.
Oh, okay. We're talking about different seductions. The first seduction is when they get onto the train.
Oh, shit.
So the very first thing, this is what, like a second after Craig's given his speech about using men, they sneak onto a train that's going to, like a freight train.
My God, sorry, how could I have forgotten? Yeah, Christ.
In fairness, there are many, many seductions, so you've got a lot to choose from. So they sneak onto a freight train that's going to New York, and then they get busted by some kind of ticket guy.
Train guard, yeah.
And so this is the moment she snaps into action and is like, wait a minute, let's get to know each other a little bit. So there's like a oil candle thing, and she turns that down. And I just was in that moment, well, okay, I see that this is very much a preco film. I mean, it's already, I've never, a film that's so old, that's so being so upfront about her father pimping her out is like already a lot. But then on top of this, there's no two ways about it. It's clear that she is now going to have sex with this man so that they are allowed to get the train illegally to New York, sneak on the train. And that was another scene that was cut from the censored version.
Oh, yeah. You shared a document with me which compared the censored and the uncensored version of Babyface, because there was a censored cut, and it completely changes the film. Like, the whole call to action by Craig is completely changed, and he tells her basically that there's a wrong way to act and a right way, so you must act the right way. And then obviously we get a censored version of her acting, how she acts in the film. And then towards the end, there's an update from Craig, who sends her a book with a little note saying, you've chosen the wrong way, you must remember the right way. So that's how they get around it.
And Nietzsche is completely cut out.
Oh, yeah. Don't want that corrupting the minds of people.
So wild.
Only the Bible is allowed.
It's just so wild that it would be put in the first place, only to be taken out. Like, to even use philosophy in a film, this would never happen today. So I just think it's very cool that this was in a film.
Oh yeah, I loved it. I was not expecting it.
Not at all.
So, yeah, I'd totally forgotten that that was her first seduction. But so what do we think just of Barbara Stanwyck and her character? And her, like, apart from Double Indemnity, I've not seen her anything else. But I was like, she's got the riz, as the kids might say. She's got a good screen presence, I thought.
She does have a very good screen presence. And she's like a beautiful woman. With my today eyes, I'm not sure if it seems totally plausible that she would be able to seduce men quite so effectively and quite so easily and overtly. Oh, I mean,
the whole film's implausible, but yes.
Yeah, of course. But that's the thing, it's like, what's very funny about this film, right, is that its depiction of gender relations and how men and women are is quite hilarious because it is so...
Oh, it's written and directed by men, so...
Well, yeah. But men also live in this world and know stuff. And they very much portray it as, like, I don't think it's just that. I think it's just like a caricature, right? It's like men are easily seduced by women and will do whatever they want and will happily be taken advantage of. If a woman is attractive enough, she can be a complete seductress and completely ruthless and doesn't have any feeling for the men she exploits. And obviously that's not a criticism. I'm not saying like, oh, yeah, why isn't this film more nuanced? I enjoy the fact that this film is so caricatured. It's very fun. And in so doing, I think it is putting forward a version of feminism that is, I think, it would be controversial today. You know, this film is celebrating the commodification of sex and women essentially selling their sexuality or using it for reasons other than to connect with someone and have feelings for them. And I think that is not something that is uncontroversial today. So I'm just very impressed really by a film doing that. I think it's a cool idea to explore. You know, whether or not it really works in actuality and anyone would really be this way is a question. But like, I like that a film explores that, and no film today I think would have the guts to do that. Or maybe, you know, very rarely, not a mainstream film anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, I think the film is presented like in a bit of a caricatured cartoon-esque way. I mean, the fact that the baby-faced little tune pops up every time she's about to do a seduction, it's, you know, it's like, it's a bit like she's a supervillain kind of character. You know, it's a heightened cartoon world. And if you kind of get into that frame of mind, that's what it is. It's not trying too hard to make a big point. It's just,
I disagree.
Like,
I think it's making a huge point. I mean, maybe it's not trying to, but I think because this whole film, we watch this woman ascend class and her financial circumstance by seducing men to get to a higher role in her job. Because basically, sorry, we're skipping over the plot, but they get to New York and she lands a job in an office by seducing the HR guy, which I think was the seduction you were talking about. So just remind me of what, I can't really remember that one so much.
Well, they kind of flirt a little bit, and she suggests that he comes because she wants to get a job, and he's saying there's no jobs available, something along those lines. And she says, "Oh, why don't we go into the office and discuss this further?" Words to that effect. And then they go into the office, and I thought it would stay outside the office, like, I, you know, especially because I guess I'm used to seeing a lot of postcode films. It's like that would be where it would end, or maybe you'd see a silhouette at the most of them kissing. But no, we go into the office and we see the whole like seduction. The camera's very much on Barbara Stanwyck's face as she turns on like the husky voice, like, "Oh, baby face, you're so irresistible. I'll give you that, whatever you want, baby face." And then off we go.
Yeah, and then from there she has this job, like a sort of a lower, not lower, but a more entry-level job.
It's an entry-level job.
And then it's at that point she seduces John Wayne, lovely John Wayne, and babyface John Wayne. And then from there, a more senior person, she keeps seducing a more senior man, and they start to give her money. She's sort of like a sugar baby for these guys because most of them are engaged or married.
Oh yeah, she's a home wrecker. But one thing I love, just, you know, from the filmmaking side, there's a little visual to help you see what's happening as she kind of ascends the ladder, which is there's a model shot of the building she's working at, and the camera moves up the model each time she seduces a new person to show that she's working her way up the company, up the corporate ladder. And then as she gets bigger and bigger, the shot finally towards the end, it's like this huge kind of almost skyscraper that we're looking up at. So I love that there's this, you know, and it's very Wes Anderson because it's clearly a model and it's got the name of each department written on it. And I don't know, it's just like, there's clearly like some fun to be had with the ascension
Which probably inspired him, because Wes Anderson, I saw that he had said that this is the most pre-code film, and he loves it.
Really?
It's one of his favourite films.
Well, there we go, because I did think that you can see a lot of Wes Anderson riffing on those kind of things. How interesting. I didn't realise that, yeah.
And Wes Anderson movies, there is also a slight caricature. Not slight, there is a caricature with all of his characters.
Caricatured.
Yeah, which kind of serves this, whatever the broader story is.
I mean, that's one of the things I've always loved about Wes Anderson, is that kind of caricature, like heightened reality, because that reminds me of like older films, but Babyface, you can definitely see the lineage to Wes Anderson stuff.
Yes. So this is a film where we're watching her ascent by using her very powerful powers of seduction. I do think there's this like broader point to be made about that, you know. I think because she is so ruthless and unfeeling, it's very much like, this is what I've got to do to get to a certain point. But what's interesting about it, I think, is that the film, it makes it very clear that she's good at the work that she does, like not the seduction. She obviously, she's very good at that, but she's a hard worker in the job she lands. Yeah, okay, she lands it in this like under the table, as it were, kind of way. When she's in these jobs, she's a good worker and does it well. And towards the end of the film, after seducing someone very senior, I think, is he like the head of the bank or something?
She seduces the head, and then he dies, and then the son comes in, the playboy son comes in to take over, isn't that right?
Right, that's it. Yeah, that's it. And the playboy
son. There's a lot going on in
this
movie.
There's a lot going on, and yet so efficiently done. So this playboy son comes in, and he sees right through her, and she's.
Yeah, he's having none of it.
Yeah, and she's trying to play the part of like, oh, I didn't know that he was married. He said he loved me. But I think I will have to sell the story, and they want to pay her off to stop her doing that. And so he, instead of paying her off, says, well, he pays her off and says, he says, I'm going to send you to Paris to work in an office there, as you obviously, you know, have been so traumatized by this and would rather, you know, you can start afresh. He obviously assumes that she'll just like scarp her once she gets to Paris, and is surprised to find her working at the Parisian office and clearly doing a good job. And I just find that quite, but I think because of that, I don't, the film very much is on Lily Powers' side, you know. Like, I don't think the film is trying to say that this is like it. I mean, on one hand, it's saying, oh, women do have this power, but it's not portraying that power as a bad thing. It's saying, this is what you need to do, but it is part of the American dream of, if you work hard enough and you take the opportunities that come your way, you can get to a certain level. And that is reflecting the fact that she is a good employee as well as a good seductress.
She's just all around very good at what she does, I guess.
Excellent work ethic across the board. But the thing, to bring it back moment to her friendship with Chico. So Chico comes with her to New York as a friend, and then she becomes Lily's maid when Lily starts to ascend and is given this like nice flat and jewels and the fab clothes. So again, you're just like, oh God, like.
But then occasionally Chico is also dressed up in his like fancy gear, just like you know. So she will alternate between her maid gear. I've noticed when Lily has guests, Chico will wear the maid gear and welcome them into the house. And then when it's them hanging out, she's kind of more dressed up.
That's true. It's actually not that's what Lily thinks Chico should be doing. It's almost like, as part of the whole double crossing, a part of the seduction is to present a certain person to these men, because that is the person they want to see, this like adorable innocent woman that, you know, hasn't been with other men and is being seduced and having this great romance with this person for the first time, and alongside that has this affluent life, has this maid, rather than the true backstory and the true reality of their relationship, I guess. So it's nuanced for sure.
Yeah, and it's interesting how just the introduction of the code, there were still black performers on screen, but I, you know, when I think the only one I can think of any note from films I've seen of Cody era would be Sam in Casablanca, you know, so that it suddenly feels like, I'm not saying portrayals got better or worse, but they seem to get more limited. That's my impression, I feel, from the code.
Well, definitely, because if you have a rule like, no, I don't even want to use that word, but if you're saying that, like,
You can't depict romance between the different races.
Exactly. Then that is, of course, going to that's segregating the screen. So it definitely like further kind of solidifies that kind of attitude. Whereas, yeah, I mean, in general, that the code will made film more conservative, or you know, or more a certain version of conservative morality, whereas before it was a lot more liberal in general, I think.
Absolutely. Like, one thing watching Babyface, I just couldn't stop thinking, was what would cinema be like right now if the Hays Code had never been enforced or existed? I mean, it's a kind of chicken egg. It's impossible. But like, I wonder where cinema would be now. Would it be like, would we have got to the 90s in the 60s? I don't know. Because I do think that the code, by limiting the storytelling and censoring, it did force the studios to try and make entertaining films, but without relying on the kind of those methods to get engaging, entertaining films, which is why it's called the golden age of Hollywood, is that a lot of the what we call classic Hollywood films are from that post-code era. And I do wonder if it's because it sharpened up their ways of making interesting stories. I don't know. It's kind of almost possible to tell.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, because they couldn't just rely on...
Shock value,
seduction, violence, gratuitousness. They had to work on other things, such as like the story, the plot, the dialogue, musical numbers.
Absolutely.
Lots of
so it forced them to do all these, and probably pushed the innovations like color, like widescreen. I know it was like that was almost TV as well, but I almost feel like it made them have to push themselves in a way that maybe they wouldn't have pushed themselves if they didn't have to have this restrictive code they were taking into account.
Yeah. And I mean, if you think about the horniness of 90s movies and the shock value, it's almost like in that era, that was when studios went back to trying to push the envelope so much. And actually all that happened was it worked for a while, but then audiences became fatigued by it. Like, people get tired of shock value after a while. But I'm very glad that we had this film before that got going.
Yeah. It just feels like a completely different type of Hollywood film. Like this, there's something about them. It feels a little bit, watching Babyface, it feels a little bit kind of, I don't know, a little edgy still, you know?
It's very edgy. Yeah. I think this is still progressive today. I think these are not, like I said before, these are not ideas that are being explored. People don't want to explore the idea of sex being used in a non-romantic or just equal. It being used as, even though sex is, of course, so intertwined with power, people don't like to explore that.
Yeah, we don't like to explore it, do we? Yeah, it's left unexplored. We only experience it in our actual real lives, and it's, you know, I don't know.
I watched How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days last weekend. Actually, I was like, this film is very much a precursor to that film. But with How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, they do not have sex during this film, with the film, which is, seems completely implausible that these people who are seeing each other every single night and clearly fancy each other. I mean, Matthew McConaughey is like the most potent. He has this like way of seducing his actresses. He's just got the riz. But that film is very much like, in a much less upfront way, doing the same thing of showing how people can use attraction and seduction in order to do something else. You know, they're trying to seduce each other in order to win a bet or do other things outside of this relationship. It's order to get further ahead in whatever they're pursuing. And this film did that, you know, 90 years before. Without, or maybe 80 years before, but in a way more upfront, brazen way. It's just a kind of amazing to see.
And you know, I'm glad you brought it back to some kind of modern kind of equivalent to Babyface, because it made me, the ending of Babyface really made me immediately think of the ending of The Ugly Truth, the kind of Catherine Heigl, is it Heigl? Catherine Heigl and Gerard Butler rom-com. I don't know if you've seen that at all.
I have not seen that. No? I tried to avoid Gerard Butler.
like same here, really, but it was recommended by a friend. They were like, you might actually like this, and I actually didn't mind it but it's like Gerard Butler plays essentially a sociopath, a very unlikable manipulative man who Catherine Heigl is like entangled with, and then suddenly in the last 15 minutes of the film he just becomes a nice guy, and there's no real reason that he became a nice guy apart from we need the romantic ending where they kiss each other and we all feel happy and leave the cinema. And I felt that a bit with Babyface, where right towards the end she suddenly doesn't care about the money and the diamonds because she's found love with this playboy character. I was like, not 100% buying it. It feels like they needed to give us that ending so we felt like we liked the character in the end. I don't know.
I liked the ending because that was a moment to me that felt like it rung quite true in a way. Because so what happens is once she's in Paris and she runs back into this Playboy again, they start seeing each other. And unlike all the other times, she doesn't want to sleep with him, and she's disappointed that he is like every other guy and clearly does want to sleep with her, because she actually has feelings for this one finally after all this time of just using men and not having any feeling for them, and you know, happily seducing them and then leaving them in the dust once she finds someone else. So she's upset with him, but then they do get together, they get married, right? They get married, and then he has some kind of financial issue with the bank, and she has all this money, and so he wants her to like help her out and give him the money. And she's like, well, no, because then I'll have nothing. Bye. But then she's like, wait, no, I've made a mistake. She goes and finds him. He's like dying for some reason. I don't know why I don't remember. I guess by the
because there's a lot. Lily, there is a lot happening in this film. I mean, like, it's just.
Guys, watch it to see for yourself. But. And sorry that we spoiled it, I realize now. But hey, it's still worth a watch, guys. It's definitely worth a watch.
Yeah, it's still worth a watch.
And she's like, actually, I don't care about any of this. I just want to be with you. I love you. And you're right. In some sense, it does feel a bit tacked on, perhaps. But actually, to me, what I liked about it was that I think the thing that is often... I think there is this idea that if you see sex as potentially a commodity, then you must have no feeling for men or whoever you're having that sex with at all, and that you are like a feelingless, you know, robot that is just using people. And actually, I don't think that is true at all. I think it's perfectly plausible that you can see sex as that, but then also think that it matters with certain people, with the people that you care about. Like, these two things to me aren't contradictory, and yet that is never really shown. And then, and if you don't ever like express that, then you're actually taking a moral stand about it and saying like one thing is bad and one thing is good. Like, there is a right way to do sex, which is like in a relationship or in some kind of relationship with where you guys are equals and it's not a power thing. And that's the other way. Like, I don't think that is necessarily true. So I like that, because I was like, yeah, like, it's perfectly possible for her to finally fall for a guy, especially to be honest, at the point where she's managed to do the thing she wanted to do. She's got to the point in society, she's risen up to where she wants to be and she feels secure. She's gotten away from the fucked up childhood she had. And so she's kind of now ready to find someone, because she is still a human
being.
She's now
ready to settle down.
You know, you can be ruthless and use people, but also have feelings and care about people. So I didn't mind it. I did mind that her saying, oh, I don't care about money, like whatever, because I don't believe that to be true.
No, I was like, really, Babyface? Really?
But that's something you can say in the moment when you're looking at the person you love and they might be dying. Like, it's what you can say. But then
the next day you'd be like, oh, you know what though, actually, maybe not.
Yeah, but you can, but then it's like, but we'll build our life together, you know? Like, I think, like, I like the fact that the film ends in a quite ambiguous note, whereas, let's bring it back to the censored version. In the censored version, I think we need to explain about the censored version, but before we get to that, that ending was, there was an extra scene tacked on to the end where they end up back in her hometown and he's working at like a steel mill, her husband or something, and she's got no money and they're perfectly happy because obviously the message has to be that this kind of seduction is no good. You need to go back to your roots and be modest.
Yeah, exactly. You need to forget all that and go back to your roots and that's the only way to be happy. Yeah, happy. I think what they did, I think it sounds like they reshot some of the board members in a boardroom reading a letter from either Babyface or the guy saying, this is what we're up to now. And the very last shot of the film that the credits go over is a shot of like the factory with the smokestacks coming out of it where he now works. So just like,
yeah.
Right, okay. Yeah.
Because even though this film was made, this prequel film was made, which speaks to where cinema was at before the code was properly enforced, it was a weird moment where these films were being censored, even though so basically this film got made, it did get submitted because there was this board that was reviewing films and making suggestions in order for the films to be released. So the actual film that people saw in the cinema, which was a hit, I think they made back their money like four times over.
Oh, great.
That was like the censored, chopped up version. No one had seen the original version until 2005 when it was discovered. 2004 when it was rediscovered.
Which was a revelation to me. I had no idea. When I watched the film, it was only when I did the research afterwards that I was like, oh, right. So we're seeing the version that the public didn't see. So the version that was the smash was the heavily censored version. I mean, but it doesn't sound anywhere near as fun as the version that I feel very fortunate that it was rediscovered. I mean, it's a fascinating glimpse of what was considered too hot to be shown to the public at the time.
But it was, so it was actually the censored version, which was the one that caused outrage and scandal and was what made us move into the code era. That's what's wild to me. I'm like, God, they didn't even see the most outrageous version. Their minds would have been blown.
Yeah, it would have been, yeah, who knows what would have happened to main America if they'd have seen that. But yeah, in 2005, it was deemed culturally and historically significant. So it was preserved in the US Library of Congress. Wow. Which is a huge honor. I think there's only about a dozen films each year that are awarded that. So it means that that's now preserved and saved. That's fantastic. Yeah. So clearly, even the American government realized how important the film was to preserve.
Yeah. A very important film. And I don't say that lightly.
And a very enjoyable watch, you know.
So much fun. Strongly recommend it. If you really want to understand the history of Hollywood's horniness, start with this movie. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. You can watch it.
Yeah, I feel like this very small window is quite a rich seam to mine. I mean, Design for Living that we covered, I thought was a great film, you know. So
yeah, I mean, we've done Thrapples. We've done pro sex work, essentially, or like proto sugar babies. Love it. What is next?
What
is next? So stay tuned for that.
Stay tuned.
Okay, so shall we finish up with a trip to the film pharmacy?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, so we have this question. Hi, guys. I'm looking for a new film to watch, something in the thriller genre, akin to The Prestige, Shutter Island, The Usual Suspects. Any recommendations?
Now that it's a specific kind of thriller, isn't it? They're all twist at the end, kind of twisty surprise thrillers. So,
oh, that's a very good point.
And those are the three big ones. Like if someone said, tell me a film that's like The Prestige, I might say Shutter Island, or, you know, I would suggest one of those three. So, you know, my first three films that I would suggest are all included in that suggestion. So I had to just cast my net a little bit wider.
Okay, and what did you come to?
Well, what I decided actually staying in Hollywood was probably not going to get as a film that this person hadn't seen. So I figured let's just go a little bit wider than this. And I settled on South Korean film Old Boy by Park Chan-wook, which I think will give you that kind of thriller with a bit of a somethingy twist coming up.
I love that suggestion. I still haven't watched Old Boy, actually. I've seen the obviously infamous octopus scene, squid scene. Was it an octopus or was it a squid? It's very large.
Squid?
Must be.
I think, yeah.
Yeah. But I really do want to watch that movie. Good choice. Solid choice.
Thanks. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's like, it's in that bracket of that kind of film. What about yourself, Lulu?
Okay. Well, you make a good point about the twist element. Because I have to say, I've seen The Prestige at some point. I feel like we've discussed this before. But I don't really remember it.
It's my favourite Christopher Nolan film.
I can't believe we haven't talked about it on this podcast, then, James. We'll have to get to it. We did a whole... Oh, no. We'll remember when we did our twist episode and we didn't know how to find movies we hadn't seen without discovering what the twist was. That was an absolute nightmare.
Well, you live and you learn, don't you, Lily? You live and you learn on this podcast.
And I had this horrible experience of watching Shutter Island where I was like 15 or maybe a bit younger, I don't know. But it was the first time my sister and I were, or one of the first times we were at home without our parents and I was going to cook for us. It was like kind of a big deal. And I found this recipe for prawn fajitas.
This is so... Unlikely, this anecdote. I love it.
So I follow this recipe, which required a lot of chili. And because I was new to cooking, this was a new experience. I didn't think about the fact that maybe I should choose for myself the level of heat. I just followed the recipe. And I made these fajitas and the prawns were so, so spicy. It was like unbearable. And rather than just not eating them, because, you know, we've been brought up not to waste, my sister and I just like... suffered through watching Shutter Island, drinking gallons of milk in between eating these like horribly, horribly spicy fajitas. And wow. So now whenever I think of Shutter Island, I think of this like burning pain. Right.
what an association to have with
it's a weird association,
film.
I have to say. So I also barely remember the movie because I was quite preoccupied with this, with what was happening on my plate. But that's all a tangent. But what came to mind was Killer Joe. It came out in 2012, directed by William Friedkin. It's a movie where Matthew McConaughey plays the titular Killer Joe. And he is the darkest character, scariest part I've ever seen him play. He's really good at it, really good. It's also got Gina Gershon in it, who I know you love.
Oh, excellent, yeah.
Yeah, and it's just a very... it's a creepy film. It's like quite intense. And I don't remember any twists. There may have been a twist. So the association. Oh, or
is that a twist, Lily? So the person watching it doesn't know there's a twist coming.
Yeah, maybe I'm leading you down the gun. But it's just a really, really, it stayed with me. And it's kind of a film that it didn't come out all that long ago. But I feel like the year it came out, there was quite a lot of buzz because it was during Matthew McConaughey's
Reconnaissance.
And it's kind of slightly, like, you never really hear about it now. But it's a good movie. I'd really recommend it. Very exciting. Okay.
I think that's two quite different recommendations there. So take your pick, please, listener.
All right. Well, thank you very much for listening to another episode of Groovy Movies.
Absolutely. And if you could find your way to leaving us a like or a 5-star review, it all helps get our podcast out into the bigger world.
So we'll see you in 2 weeks' time. Bye.
Bye.
Follow us on Instagram at groovymoviespod or email us groovymoviespod@gmail.com.
Groovy Movies was produced and edited by Lily Austin.
Music and sound by James Brailsford.
Our logo was designed by Abby Jo Sheldon.
For references and more information about the films discussed, check out the show notes.